I'm going to read from the scriptures, from Romans chapter 2, cutting in at verse 17. We're looking at the book of Romans, we're looking at Paul's arguments, he's laying out the background to the gospel. When we've read this passage, we'll sing one more hymn, and then we'll look at it in more detail. Romans chapter 2 and verse 17. Indeed, you are called a Jew, and dressed on the law, and make your boast in God, and know his will, and approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. You therefore who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say, do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you, it is written. For circumcision is indeed profitable if you keep the law. But if you are a breaker of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. Therefore, if an uncircumcised man keeps the righteous requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be counted as circumcision? And will not the physically uncircumcised, if he fulfills the law, judge you who, even with your written code and circumcision, are a transgressor of the law? For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh. For he is a Jew who is one inwardly. And circumcision is that of the heart, in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God. In Romans chapter 2, Paul is making a point about hypocrisy, and I said last Sunday that hypocrisy was one of those sins or crimes which, when Jesus was on earth, he really condemned perhaps more than any other. He met a whole range of people when he was on earth. He met tax collectors, those who robbed people in the name of Caesar. He met prostitutes. He met all sorts of people. And although he did not approve of what they did, the people to whom he gave the hardest time were the religious teachers, the Pharisees, those who preached one thing but perhaps lived another. And Paul in Romans chapter 2 is addressing perhaps all the Jews who at that time were thinking that because of their Jewish heritage, because of their background, that somehow guaranteed salvation and assured them of peace with God, when in fact the message of the book of Romans is that Jesus Christ has come and through him we have salvation. He is, we can put it this way, our passport to forgiveness. In Romans 2, verse 17, he describes the reason that God called the Jewish people to be his people. Throughout the Old Testament, God was the God of a particular nation. In one respect, he was a God of all people. He is a creator of all people. And yet he had a special relationship with the Jews. They were the descendants of Abraham. They had the law of Moses. They were his special people. And in verse 17, Paul writes, indeed, you are called a Jew and dressed on the law and make your boast in God and know his will and approve the things that are excellent, being instructed out of the law, and are confident that you yourself are a guide to the blind, a light to those who are in darkness, an instructor of the foolish, a teacher of babes, having the form of knowledge and truth in the law. God had chosen the Jewish people as a beacon on a hill. So although all the other descendants of Adam had been corrupted by the sin from Eden, yet there was a people who still knew the one true God. If you're familiar with the story of Jonah, we have a picture of that. Nineveh was an especially wicked city. Even by the standards of the ancient world, it was a cruel place. And God sent Jonah, a Hebrew prophet, not to the Hebrew people, but to the people of Assyria, the people of Nineveh, to remind them of the God of heaven and the standard which he expected them to live by. The Hebrews, the Israelites, were Jews, were a light to the Gentiles. In verse 21, though, Paul resumes again the theme of hypocrisy. You, therefore, who teach another, do you not teach yourself? You who preach that a man should not steal, do you steal? You who say, do not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? adultery. I put it to you this morning that adultery and stealing are sins which God finds loathsome and offensive. Yet more loathsome and offensive is the man who tells others not to do such things, but then goes ahead and does them himself. Not only does he accrue the blame for having commissioned the offence, but also the blame for hypocrisy. Let me read to you some words from the 23rd of Matthew. Here Jesus is talking to and of the Pharisees, and many of these people, depending on when the book of Romans were being written, many of these people Paul may have known. In Matthew 23, Matthew writes, "Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do." Sometimes we have to be reminded that the Pharisees, when it came to theology and when it came to how to live, often, usually, got it right. Jesus said, do as they tell you. But unfortunately, he says, but do not do according to their works. For they say and do not do. For they bind heavy burdens hard to bear and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do to be seen by men. There is a challenge. I put it to you, friends, that officially, according to the history books, the Pharisees kind of died out when the temple died out in AD 70. And yet the spirit of the Pharisee has continued. Here, the spirit of the Pharisee is one who does good deeds, but only to be seen by other people. Friends, I pray that when we do good deeds, and I hope we do it for their own sake or for the sake of our Father in heaven, not so other people will see us doing them and give us praise and public thanks. They make their phylacteries broad and enlarge the borders of their garments. This was the little part of the law that they tended to wear on the forehead, and the tassels on the garments indicating holiness. They wanted everybody to see that. They love the best places at feasts and the seats in the synagogues, greetings in the marketplaces, and to be called by men Rabbi, Rabbi. Of course, Rabbi means teacher. But you do not be called Rabbi, for one is your teacher, the Christ, and you are all brethren. Do not call anyone on earth your father, for one is your father, he who is in heaven. And do not be called teachers, for one is your teacher, the Christ. I make no judgment upon other men who are ministers or pastors. Let me make that clear from the beginning. But that's one of the reasons that I like to be called plain old Alan Marsden. And not because other people like to be called reverend or right reverend this, that or the other. That's between them and God. The Pharisees in the first century were very fond of people giving them religious titles and religious claims, and I think it's good perhaps not to be in that position. And in verse 11 he tells his wife, "For he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. And whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." Jesus in the gospel turns things upside down. He who is praised by men perhaps receives little praise from God. And he or she who quietly goes on with good works, not in order to be saved, that's not the message of Romans, but because we are saved, perhaps on that day of reckoning, God will have many good things to say to that person. And in verse 13, Jesus is no longer meek and mild. He says, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation." Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte. That means a convert. And when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. Woe to you blind guides who say, "Whoever swears by the temple, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it." Fools and blind, for which is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, it is nothing. But whoever swears by the gift that is on it, he is obliged to perform it. The Pharisees at the time of Jesus would say that if you make such and such a religious oath, by the temple or by the altar. You have to obey it, but if you obey it by, if you swear it by this object, you don't need to obey it well. Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, let your yes be yes and your no be no. Let us not spend time quibbling over what we ought to swear by. Let us instead be honest people. The early Quakers, perhaps modern Quakers as well, often made a point of not swearing an oath. So when Charles II came back and required people to swear their oath of loyalty to him, the Quakers were thought to be traitors and seditious people because they refused to swear. Of course, their point is that if you can only tell someone is telling the truth because they make a promise on a holy book, does that mean they're lying the rest of the time? Would it not be better simply to tell the truth all the time, and therefore swearing oaths on holy books is simply never required? Fools and blind, Jesus continues, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore he who swears by the altar swears by it and by all things on it. He who swears by the temple dwells by it and by him who dwells in it. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. He doesn't pull his punches, does he? For you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These were people who, if they grew particular types of herb, would make sure that the temple received an exact tenth, thus fulfilling the Old Testament law. But while they were busy measuring out to the exact limit the amount of wealth they would give to God, they were neglecting being fair with people. They were neglecting showing mercy to people. They were neglecting actual faith itself. Jesus says, these you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. He's not saying, don't bother giving money away, don't bother supporting the temple, just be fair and merciful to people. He's saying, no, do both. Do both. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and yet swallow a camel. Jesus comes across as really quite angry here, but he's actually told a joke. Imagine if you've got a drink and there's a fly in it. Would you not get rid of the fly before you drank it? Of course he would. But Jesus says the Pharisees at his time are such hypocrites that if a gnat or a fly lands in a drink, they'll go to great lengths to get it out. And yet at the same time, if a camel landed in their drink, they'd drink the whole lot. Clearly impossible. But I imagine the original audience would have rather laughed at that. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you cleanse the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also. One reason I use a dishwasher at home is not entirely because I'm idle, but because it's the one way I have of guaranteeing the cups will actually be clean. See, I have a habit of cleaning the cups and they look good, but then when I dry them on the inside, there's still bits of muck. You can't drink from that. What good is some crockery that has been cleaned on the outside only? It's the inside it needs to be clean. But here Jesus talks of the Pharisees. Outwardly they look clean, they look holy, they look righteous, and yet inwardly they're full of sin and filth. He says, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you who also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. Jesus goes on and on and on. Because the sin or the crime of which those Pharisees were charged was that of hypocrisy. And here Paul in Romans chapter 2 is addressing the same thing. They who say do not steal, themselves steal. They who say do not commit adultery, themselves commit adultery. And then we have this strange expression, you who are poor idols, do you rob temples? Various commentators have expressions for it. Some think that these Jewish people about whom Paul is writing, although they claim to hate idols, are perhaps making money out of it. Perhaps some of them were making the idols, or perhaps some of them were skimming some of the money that was meant to be paid to the temple. I don't know. But the charge, of course, is hypocrisy. In verse 23, Paul writes, "You who make your boast in the law, do you dishonor God through breaking the law? For the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you." I don't know if you have ever noticed, but when a prominent Christian, or perhaps I should just say a religious person, commits a crime, it tends to be more newsworthy than if somebody else does it. So, for example, if the vicar runs off with the organist or something like that, it will probably make a tabloid headline, whereas if Joe Meatball, who lives at number 23 down the road, does it, it is not interesting. Because religious people are set up as being more moral than the rest, and perhaps, generally speaking, there is some truth in that. And yet, when a Christian or even a so-called Christian does something wrong, perhaps God is even more ashamed. Paul writes in that 23rd verse, "The name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Do you dishonor God through breaking the law?" Then from verse 25, he talks about circumcision. Now, this is not something that I would normally want to dwell on a Sunday morning. People who convert fully to Judaism, who are male, are expected to go through with an operation. As you can imagine, there are not many grown-up male converts to Judaism, but those who do must be pretty committed. I imagine it's a very painful process that will last some time. But I'm sure you're aware that the Jewish people, or rather I should say the Hebrews, were required to be circumcised. In Genesis chapter 17 verse 9 we read, "And God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised. And you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and that shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised. Every male child in your generations, he who is born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant." In other words, God had this special agreement with the Israelites that he would be their God and they would be his people, and each of their males would carry a sign of that covenant on their body. There is a fashion nowadays for tattoos. You may have noticed it. Young men will have tattoos going all up the arms and up the neck and all over the place. And I wouldn't like to break it to them, but one day those tattoos will be out of fashion. But they will still have them. It happened back in the 70s, it will happen again in the 20-teens. But a tattoo is a mark done to the body that cannot be removed. And circumcision, I guess, is more than a mark. It's an operation performed on here it's the male body. There is an issue with a female circumcision, but here it's male circumcision. And clearly, once it is done, it cannot be altered or reverted to or put back. And God had an agreement, a special relationship with the Israelites, and they would carry a sign of that relationship on their body. Some of you will know the story of David and Goliath. And little David stands against huge Goliath, and the two face each other. And David talks of the uncircumcised Philistine. Who is he to stand up against the armies of the Lord? You see, circumcision for Jewish people was, and I imagine still is, a sign of that special relationship God had with Abraham. It was an outward sign of something that God had granted, a favor that he had granted. And at the time of Paul, where you've got Jewish Christians as well as Jews who are considering the claims of Christ, many of them were perhaps thinking that, well, I've been circumcised on my eighth day. I don't need Jesus Christ. The message of the book of Romans is that Christ came to save everyone, both Jew and Gentile. And so the Gentiles of whom we read last week, who perhaps did not have the law, have the law of God written on their hearts, are without excuse. But also the Jew, who though he received that sign of circumcision when he was a baby, is also without excuse if he is without Christ. Paul says, but if you are a breaker of the law, your circumcision has become uncircumcision. You know, there was a problem in the early church, and you'll be aware that most of the early Christians in the first century were of Jewish heritage. Now, the word Jew, of course, is both a racial term and a religious term. And therefore, it's possible to be a Jew, like Karl Marx, racially, without believing in God, and therefore not being a religious Jew. Likewise, if I wanted to, I don't. I could convert to Judaism, go through that rather painful operation hitherto described, and religiously I could become a Jew. Racially, I remain a white European. So Jew is both a racial and a religious term. But in the first century, the early Jewish Christians had to decide, do you need to be circumcised in order to go to heaven? To become a saved person, a person forgiven by God, a recipient of the grace of God, must one be circumcised? And many of those Jewish believers said yes. And if you're familiar with the book of Galatians, one of the issues with which Paul tackles is that circumcision is not required of believers. If I need to be circumcised to go to heaven and to be forgiven of my sin, then Jesus need not have died on the cross. If Jesus died on the cross, but I still need to be circumcised, then what he achieved at Calvary wasn't sufficient. It needs to be added to. And Paul's argument in the book of Galatians, and to some extent here in the book of Romans, is that circumcision itself is worthless. Because Paul says, a Jewish male who breaks the law of God, though he be circumcised, may as well not be. Because circumcision itself means nothing unless there is something on the inside. Now remember when Jesus railed against the Pharisees, outwardly they were great. They had great religious titles, they wore great religious clothes, they said the longest prayers. They made sure that they tithed minutely and methodically to the temple. And yet inwardly they were full of filth. They were circumcised, but inwardly they were full of filth. You see, the outward symbol is worthless if it does not have inner reality. In verse 26, Paul writes, therefore, if an uncircumcised man keeps the righteous requirements of the law, will not his uncircumcision be counted as circumcision? The spiritual man, the man who keeps the law of God, the man who is in Christ, spiritually speaking, has been circumcised without, I hasten to add, the incredible physical pain. Now, I don't imagine that many people in here were thinking, gosh, shall I be circumcised in order to be saved? And yet there are equivalents, I think, within the church of circumcision. Take, for example, baptism. Whether you were dipped as a baby or dunked as an adult, some people in here have done either. Baptism itself does not save anyone. Medieval people liked to have their babies baptized as quickly as possible, because it was thought that if the baby dies without having had those drops of water on its forehead, it would have to burn in hell. Well, I don't think God works that way. And even the Catholic Church has changed its mind on that. And yet, baptism does not save anyone. I was baptized, well, I say I was baptized as an adult. I was baptized at the age of 12 by full immersion. It was at Garstang Free Methodist Church. and the minister and one of the leaders of the church asked me various questions and then plunged me under the water, and I was the 21st out of 21 to be baptized. And let me tell you, that water was quite mucky by the time it got to me. It was not the kind of pleasurable spiritual experience I'd anticipated it being. It was actually not especially nice. But friends, let me assure you, that baptism was only an outward sign of something that had happened on the inside. Those of you who believe in the baptism of infants, let me assure you, the baptism of that infant is worthless unless, when that infant grows up, there is some kind of inner witness. There is an inner reality. The grace of God is wrought within the heart. Or perhaps even communion. Last Sunday morning, we had the Lord's Supper. We had the bread. We had the wine. Let me assure you, you could come to chapel every time we have communion for years and years and years. And taking it will take not a drop of difference with God. What is important is that you understand, not just in your head, but in your heart, what has happened. And if you know that when you drink from that cup and you eat that bread represents the body of Jesus Christ that was sacrificed in your place. And that cup represents the blood that he shed at Calvary, because scripture demands the shedding of blood for the payment of sin. And that God himself became a human being that he might shed his blood, that you might not have to shed yours. When you understand that, the communion suddenly makes sense to you. And it stops being a mere rite or ritual. The outer symbol suddenly takes on incredible inner meaning. And so, of course, it is with circumcision. A circumcised man, if he lives a rotten life, might as well not have bothered. The early Christians were deciding, should converts have to be circumcised? And of course the answer is no. No. Paul writes in verse 27, and will not the physically uncircumcised, if he fulfills the law, judge you who, even with your written code and circumcision, are a transgressor of the law? For he is not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision that which is outward in the flesh, but he is a Jew who is one inwardly. If a Jew means the people of God, and if on the inside you believe in your heart that Jesus Christ died for you and was resurrected from the dead 3 days later to show that that sacrifice had been accepted, then you are as much a Jew as anyone. You see, a true child of God, or the real seed of Abraham, is one by faith. Not by physical appearance or by genetics or by DNA. Because, Paul writes, God looks at the heart. We live in an age which sets great store by how you look. How many products are available to change the colour of your hair, or to change the colour of your skin, or to make you this, do this or do that, or to have muscles here or muscles there, or But refreshingly, the Bible says that God is interested in the heart, not how tall or how thin or how fat or how short you are, but at the heart. Some of you will know the story of David, when he was anointed as king over Israel. And Saul is the king, but Saul kind of lost it. And so Samuel went to the family of Jesse. And in the 16th chapter of the first book of Samuel, we read, so it was that when they came, that he looked at Eliab and said, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. I don't know what Eliab looked like, but he possibly looked like a king. I'm not planning to share political opinions in the pulpit, but rightly or wrongly, people who win elections in this country, and especially so in America, already look the part. In other words, you look at someone and do they look like an American president? Do they look like a British prime minister? Because if they don't look like what people expect a prime minister or a president to look like, they're probably not going to win the election. And Eliab possibly looked like a future king of Israel. But in verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I've refused him. For the Lord does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks where? At the heart." Of course, when he talks about the heart, it doesn't mean that physical organ pumping blood around the body. The real heart of a man, the real heart of a woman, the innermost being, the person. The part of you that will survive when your body is buried in that graveyard outside. That's the heart of the man, the heart of the woman. Circumcision is that of the heart in the spirit, not in the letter, whose praise is not from men, but from God, Paul writes. Proverbs chapter 17 verse 3 says, "The refining pot is for silver, and the furnace for gold, but the Lord tests the heart." I know the more I talk about my amateur coin collection, the more you'll be sick of hearing about it. But some things are passed off as gold and silver, which aren't gold and silver. And sometimes a silver coin has been so mixed with other metals, you can't really call it a silver coin. And Proverbs here is talking of refining and purifying. It says, "The refining pot is for silver, and the furnace for gold. But the Lord tests the heart." This morning, God cares not that you be circumcised. Neither is he too interested in your baptism, but it's a good thing to have done. We ought to take communion, but let me assure you, your taking communion is fairly low down God's list of priorities for you. What he wants from you and what he wants from me is a pure heart. A heart that understands communion, a heart that responds and understands baptism. In the terms of Jewish people, a heart that mirrors the importance of circumcision. Let me assure you, simply putting a ring on that finger doesn't make you married. Putting a ring on that finger doesn't make you happily married. Is it the wrong one? Shows how much I know. Even on that one, it wouldn't make me any happier. You see, it's possible to be happily married and not to wear a ring. You might have lost your ring. You might have fallen down the drain in the shower. You might have lost it on the beach. A friend of mine lost his wedding ring on the beach on holiday. And there were two things that terrified him. Number one, the cost of replacing it. Number two, telling his wife. She took it well in the end. But the ring on the finger is merely an outward symbol of something far deeper. And Paul is writing here in the second of Romans. He's talking about circumcision, but we could extend its remit to baptism or communion or any other outward form or ceremony. There has to be an inner witness in the heart. That is what Christ is looking for. That is what God seeks in his people. Ezekiel 36:26 writes, "I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh." Friends, God looks at the heart, not the outward appearance. And the message Paul writes to these Jewish people who are perhaps originally reading the book of Romans is that it's Christ and him alone and your relationship to him in your heart that counts, not what was done to your body on your eighth day.